All right, welcome. So tonight we have several questions that have been pre-submitted that we'll go over. If there's additional time, I have some interesting information on antiparietal cell antibodies to cover, and feel free to also submit questions as we're going along here. So I'm going to share screen for the first question here. Okay, now if you do want to ask anything, please type that in the Q&A box. That's going to be better and easier for me to see than the chat box. And today's date is October 14th, 2019, and we have some questions here about genetics, a little bit about some cystic breasts, and a couple other things. So first question here is related to a female age 38 with familial hypercholesterolemia. And we did a pretty deep dive on this in one of the previous Q&A webinars. And familial hypercholesterolemia is something I've done a lot of research on. It's really important to me, with my father having passed on from a heart attack. And I've worked with several patients with familial hypercholesterolemia. And it's something that I think is not well treated or cared for in a lot of the functional medicine circles. So I'm glad people are asking about it. So follow-up case, client that came back to me for work on her high cholesterol. We did additional blood work, which showed high ApoB, LP little a, homocysteine, and other elevated cardiometabolic markers. She had increased plaque buildup for her age, found on the ultrasound we did with a cardiologist. I'm guessing that was a carotid intima media thickness scan. And just as an aside, a CIMT is a great preventive test for people to get, especially who have some cholesterol concerns. If the cholesterol is high, but the CIMT shows that the intima media thickness is really low for the age of the person and for the potential risk being low, then, and if there's no visible plaque, hard or soft, then that could be a really meaningful and helpful thing to add into, a screening on top of cholesterol, because cholesterol elevation in the presence of no plaque and no inflamed intima media is much less concerning than high cholesterol in the presence of soft and or hard plaque and a thickened intima media. Because we do see from some of the long-running heart trials, like the Framingham study, that there's significantly increased risk with higher intima media thickness for a cardiovascular event to happen. Plus, of course, if someone is building up plaque, we know that atherosclerotic process is going along in a way that is going to be potentially triggering of a cardiovascular event in some cases. So we know that the mechanism that atherosclerosis happens is that the high cholesterol has to collide into the artery wall, get stuck there, oxidize, inflame, and then the body's repair processes, if it can't deal with it fast enough, wind up laying down plaque as a protective function against the injury to the arterial wall. And if we see those arterial walls thickening, that's a sign that there's more injury to those walls. And if we see plaque buildup, then that's a sign that it's even more advanced, to where the body's not able to repair appropriately. And so there's plaque laying down to try to address that injury, which then is higher potential for a cardiovascular event. So in that case, in this case, we saw increased plaque buildup for her age on an ultrasound. So there, it sounds like not only is high cholesterol, but there's extra risk that we've seen on an ultrasound, probably carotid intima media thickness ultrasound. And she knows a statin is indicated in this case, but is she's decided to spend 3 to 4 months doing everything she can from a dietary lifestyle and supplement standpoint to see if there's any change before considering the statin, put together a plan and use input from the previous Q&A. Also did ancestry DNA test. This is the first time this person's done, first time Brooke's done Stratagene. And just FYI, Stratagene isn't the one that we use in the office for doing these DNA test interpretations. So I will go through it, but I'm less familiar with it than the DNA supplementation one that I usually use, but we'll go through and we'll talk about it. And then, so we have that result that we'll be able to go through. Also have two additional questions here. She does start on a statin drug. Are there any supplements aside from CoQ10 that would be indicated to continue to take along with the statin once we get follow-up labs to assess if anything has changed over 4 months of diet and supplementation? We'll follow up here too. And then two, she found a study on Chinese medicine treatment for familial hypercholesterolemia. Didn't give me the whole study, but uploaded what she gave me to Dropbox. Just curious if we run across the protocol listed and any thoughts we might have. Client's highly adverse to statin drug, but clearly her labs are indicated high cardiovascular risk. She wants to cover all bases. So if she does choose the statin, she can feel content in her choice that she tried all the other options available to her. We've reduced her diet to 20% fat and mostly monounsaturated fatty acids. She's eating high amounts of colorful vegetables. She's on the supplement protocol that was suggested when we first went over this case. It will be interesting to see if there's any change with labs in a month or two. We'll definitely follow up. Okay, great. So let's go over the Stratagene report. So we may have two different Stratagene reports. So I want to make sure we're on the right one. Brooke, if you're on this, let me see if you're on this call. I'm not sure. Brooke, if you happen to be on this call, will you comment about if this is the Stratagene report for this person? Because we do have two different ones in here from you. So give me a comment. But we'll go over this, assuming that this is for her. And if not, then we'll go into a little more detail. You know, we'll change things around. So here we have MTHF D1 has a homozygous. So generally, a wild type is going to be a minus minus. A heterozygous mutation is going to be a plus minus colored yellow, and a homozygous mutation is going to be a plus plus colored red. So when we're looking at SNPs or single nucleotide polymorphisms, really we're looking at them in the context of these are genetic predispositions, and these genetic predispositions are going to be either the wild type that's the type that most people are, most people are, and the wild type isn't always a good thing. Usually it is, but there are certain cases where a mutated or non-wild type means you can, for example, the wild type gene related to lactase enzyme means that after being a baby when growing up, there stops being the production of the lactase enzyme. So digesting dairy products and lactose sugar becomes more difficult. But there's actually been a variant that is not the wild type that has allowed people to now be able to keep producing that lactase enzyme later into life, which means they're more likely to be lactose tolerant and can have dairy with breaking down that lactose sugar. It says nothing about the immune reaction to the protein in dairy like casein, but it says that the sugar in dairy, the lactose, has an enzyme called lactase that breaks it down that gets produced by people who had that genetic variant. So some genetic variants are positive, some genetic variants are negative. So the wild type generally is a good thing, but not always. And then the heterozygous is one mutation, the homozygous is two mutations. And we don't know for each gene if there's increased activity or decreased activity. For some genes, we know that the research shows that there's more of a decreased activity from this polymorphism, more of an increased activity from this polymorphism. But basically, you know, these genes are making proteins, and those proteins, the enzymes that make those proteins can be upregulated or downregulated by a genetic change. So that's a little back info here on this. Okay, then we have MTHFD1 with the homozygous. So I'm just starting with the homozygouses. We have the NOS3 ENOS homozygous. We have COMT. We have MAOB homozygous, and we have two COMT homozygous. Then we have a few heterozygous. So we have the AOC1 Trillis DAO, and then we have GSTP1. We have CBS, which is C699T, is the most significant of the CBS mutations. And then we have MTRR, which relate to vitamin B12, but there's not a ton of clinically applicable information about MTRR. I can go into that if we have time. MTHFR, C677T is the most significant. A1298C is the second most significant. And with a heterozygous mutation in both, there is likely to be some methylation issue here. So probably a lowered enzyme activity of 30-40% or so in this case for MTHFR, which is the enzyme that activates folate with a methyl, with a methyl group. So let's go into the details. Let's go down a little bit. A couple more homozygous, a TNF-alpha, an ApoE. Unfortunately, the said ApoE genotype is indeterminate. So ApoE genotype, because ApoE genotype is determined by these two together, and it looks like her genetic information only pulled one instead of both of those. But given this mutation, it looks like there might be an ApoE 3-4 or 4-4, in which case that increases cardiovascular disease risk as well as Alzheimer's and dementia. Then we have several heterozygous mutations. One of them is in the HFE, which is related to iron overload. So we may see some iron overload minor issues when, for a postmenopausal woman with this one change. So that's possible. It may not be an issue at all. So we want to consider that. So PEMT relates to choline. HFE is going to be something where we're going to want to I'll get into suggestions a little later. HFE, we may want to test iron status. So we may want to transferrin saturation, serum iron, and ferritin. For PEMT, that can relate to choline need being greater. So choline we may be looking at with PEMT. Those are some of the biggies that I'm seeing off the bat here. So let's go a little more into the folate cycle. And here we see that this is part of how folates and folic acid become the methyl folate, that then the methyl folate goes into the cycle to recycle homocysteine. And so here we're going to have several areas where there can be an issue, but the MTHFR enzyme is the biggest one that tends to get affected. And there's a few things that are going to inhibit or slow down this enzyme, a few things that are going to speed up this enzyme. And the genetic mutation is, there is one heterozygous mutation for this and a couple homozygous mutations for the MTHFD1 has homozygous mutations. So we see a couple issues in the methylation or in the methyl, the ability to methylate folate here. So some of the things that we would want to watch out for are, we want to watch out for homocysteine elevating on a blood test primarily is going to be our biggest sign that there's an issue. We can also look for symptoms of low methylation, which would be symptoms with histamine issues. So histamine sensitivity, there would be potentially some increased chances for, there's increased chances for cardiovascular disease risk. So we definitely want to address it with that because homocysteine relates to that. There's potential for increased headaches or migraines, fatigue. There could be mental, emotional issues as well. Could be reclusiveness, less social, less interactive with other people. So these folate cycle SNPs. So first it's talking about this SLC SNP. And basically it's saying with this SLC SNP that you want to avoid folic acid. So folic acid, you know, some people make a huge deal out of it. Some people don't make as big a deal out of it. It's probably better to avoid supplements that have folic acid when you can easily choose supplements that have a methylated folate in them instead. So that would be typically where you're going to want to go here. So basically it's saying that this gene may be decreased by about this enzyme activity may be decreased by about 50%, which would reduce the 5-formyl tetrahydrofolate transport by about half. And that could increase risk for acute leukemias. So, you know, if white blood cells start to increase and we see those increased above range a few times, then we'd want to refer for an oncology screen to look for leukemia. Now, these are just genetic predispositions. This doesn't say the person has it. So, you know, that's why we want to look at this as pointers, but we want to look at blood tests like a CBC for the white blood cells in order to see if some of these things are going to be an issue. We'll want to look at homocysteine to see if methylation is expressing. Just because you have the gene doesn't mean you express it necessarily. MTHFD1 here, so this can reduce the metabolic activity by up to 34% of this particular enzyme. It's about a third. And there may be choline deficiency. So fatty liver could be more likely to be present. And one thing that we want to keep in mind here is that with, you know, something like fatty liver, if we see elevated triglycerides above 150, especially above 200 or 300, then as a person changes their diet, they're going to be reducing, if they're reducing fatty liver, which you need a lot of choline to reduce fatty liver. And if you're doing a healthy diet, increasing choline, then you may get increased cholesterol temporarily. So if we see triglycerides go down dramatically, let's say triglycerides went from 300 to 200, the cholesterol went from 280 to 290. That actually might be progress because we will see higher cholesterol in the blood as fatty liver is broken down. And if we see that significant and positive change in a reduction of triglyceride together with that slight increase in total cholesterol or LDL cholesterol, that could be a good thing. It may mean that fatty liver is breaking down, which is releasing more fatty acids into more lipids into the bloodstream. We get a higher lipid count, but a lower triglyceride count. That's actually a healing movement for the liver, moving in the right direction. So I want to say that it's not all about cholesterol. So we want to think about triglycerides. We want to think about choline in this case. So MTHFR is, of course, the most famous of them and the most well-studied of them. But in isolation, it's not nearly as useful as in context of other things. So we see we have the 1298C, which is about a 20% reduction, and the 677T, which is about a 30% reduction, combined total of about a 50% reduction in MTHFR activity. And we see that it's mentioning Alzheimer's risk, schizophrenia as two potential things that have been associated with this mutation. There's also coronary artery disease, male infertility, hypertension, cognitive or congestive heart disease, and possibly oral class Down syndrome, fetal anticonvulsant syndrome. And again, you know, these kinds of research are interesting, but so people make big deals out of them when they don't have to necessarily. What this means essentially is that we have about a half reduction in the MTHFR enzyme. Research on MTHFR enzyme actually shows that that reduction is probably only happening in the presence of vitamin B2 deficiency or riboflavin deficiency. So if you have the genetic mutation and you have adequate riboflavin status, usually the enzyme does not downregulate. But if you have the mutation in the enzyme and you have low riboflavin status, that's when we see that there's a problem with the methylation of folate and a buildup of homocysteine and an increased risk for these things. So the most definitive research we have right now are twofold. One is getting B2 status or riboflavin status up may stop the expression of these genetics to reduce this enzyme activity. Now that's huge because most people are giving big doses of methylfolate, thinking that's the solution to the MTHFR enzyme, but the research is suggesting that riboflavin may be a better solution. And it's not required to be super high doses. A good B complex usually has enough riboflavin, but you can go higher doses. Like, for example, you could go 100, 200, 300, 400 milligrams of riboflavin for other reasons. You wouldn't need to for this reason. Probably, you know, 2 to 5 milligrams per day would be sufficient for this reason. If someone's really not absorbing well, maybe 5 to 10 would be sufficient. So that would be enough to take care of the MTHFR enzyme alone. Now there may be other things involved. There's also a doubled need for MTHF or for choline with MTHFR enzyme. That's also very clear in research. There is not really an increased need for premethylated folate, even though it's okay to have a little bit of extra premethylated folate. I'm not a big fan of 1 milligram, 2 milligram, 5 milligram doses for this because the research doesn't support that that helps. And the math for the physiology of how this works, that one, typically the way the body recycles methyl groups is such that you would need probably many hundreds of milligrams to make a significant difference in this enzyme with how many times this enzyme runs per, you know, minute. And the way that the methyl group gets recycled and the folate gets recycled is such that the math doesn't work out to try to treat this with just methylated folate in high doses. So what I recommend is 400 micrograms to 800 micrograms of methylfolate in a B complex with vitamin B2 riboflavin in it, and then to double choline. So choline need to make choline in the diet go way, way up, or take a choline supplement. And that's going to pretty much resolve it in most cases and lower the homocysteine, get that homocysteine cycle working, get methylation functioning again. And then there are a few other things that we can do, like increase B2 a little more, make sure there's some good B6 in that as well in that B complex. And then we can look also at we can look at creatine as well. So here's this homocysteine cycle. This is going to clear this up a bit for you. So homocysteine is the problem child, right? When homocysteine builds up in the blood, it's inflammatory, increases cardiovascular disease risk, increases risk of Alzheimer's and dementia. So we want to make sure that homocysteine is not building up in the blood. So we see that there's CBS mutation here, so there may be some lowered CBS. And we see that vitamin B6 and serine are going to be important for CBS to function. So vitamin B6 is one way that we can get the homocysteine to go out. So that's something to keep in mind, is that vitamin B6 is one nutrient we're going to want here. We see that zinc here helps with MTR, but there's no dysfunction with MTR. As far as we can see, MTRR has a little bit of a dysfunction. There's SAM, FAD, and NAD there, but this is probably not an issue. The only possible issue is that there could be some buildup of toxic byproduct from methylcobalamin, but this is extremely unlikely. It's basically meaningless clinically as far as we can tell at this point right now. So I would ignore the MTRR piece. Notice that from homocysteine, you can go up to methionine directly and skip this whole, the MTHFR and the MTR and the MTRR. You can skip that by going from homocysteine straight up through BHMT to methionine. So homocysteine can become methionine through MTR, which needs MTHFR, and then can use, you know, both vitamin B12 and folate that's premethylated. Or it can go up through BHMT, and BHMT uses choline and or betaine to function. So choline and or betaine will help push homocysteine to methionine, which is why if we have MTHFR and this part's not functioning as well, we can make the BHMT function stronger by increasing choline. So when we say in research there's a doubled need for choline with MTHFR mutations, that's why, is because the BHMT is where we can go through in order to bring homocysteine to methionine. And we want to get homocysteine recycling to methionine so that methionine can then become SAMe and be a methyl donor for the body, and then we are able to get the methyl donation to the different areas of the body that we need. You'll see that there's glycine in this list as well. Glycine acts like a methyl buffer. It will lower methylation, but not if it's too low. It won't lower it more. It will actually lower methylation only if it's high. So there's this buffering effect that glycine has that is important even if a person is low in methylation overall, because someone can be low in methylation overall but still over-methylating in a certain area of the body. There can be both over and under methylation happening at the same time. And we want glycine to be in place to allow for the body to be able to buffer the methylation, especially if we're going to give methyl boosters, like if we're going to give some premethylated B vitamins, if we're going to give some extra choline, if we're going to give certain other things, we want glycine to be able to slow it down. And glycine, there are two things primarily that can lower methylation. That's going to be glycine and it's going to be niacin. And niacin indiscriminately binds to methyl groups and pulls them out regardless of whether methylation is high or not. Glycine will only come into play if methylation is excessive to bring those extra methyl groups out. So glycine's the better methyl buffer unless you know someone is acutely over-methylating, in which case you could use niacin. You want to be cautious with niacin because it could push under-methylation. So a little bit of niacin in the context of a B vitamin that also has pro-methyl support like methylcobalamin and methylfolate is okay and good. Glycine itself is going to be helpful for a methyl buffer, and you're not going to want to do excessive niacin just for methylation. And if you do, we're going to want to add some things to counteract the methyl lowering effects of niacin, which niacin could be a worthy consideration in this case for the cholesterol piece, but we'd want to counteract any potential negative side effects of it if we're going to use it. So here what we see is that, I know this is kind of a complex cycle, but the biggies for us are going to be choline. So we want to pay a lot of attention to choline. We want to pay a lot of attention to vitamin B2 around this MTR and MTHFR. We want to pay attention to vitamin B2, a little bit of premethylated folate and methylated B12. And then we could also look at glycine, would be good to look at. And we may also want to look at creatine as a supplement as well, because creatine is, it spares SAMe in the body, because a lot of what the body does with SAMe is makes creatine. And if we increase creatine supplementally, we will spare SAMe, and it's a lot less expensive than taking SAMe. And it's a lot safer in that it's not going to overmethylate, because again, it will spare SAMe in the body, but it won't directly provide methyl groups itself. So because a good chunk of SAMe is going to create creatine, giving creatine will downregulate the body's conversion of SAMe to creatine, meaning more SAMe becomes available for methylation donors and doing more of the methyl effects that SAMe can have. So the SAMe utilization will be increased by taking supplemental creatine. So those are the big things, is a good quality B complex that has some methylated folate and methylcobalamin and riboflavin and vitamin B6, preferably as P5P. And then increasing choline through diet and or supplements, increasing glycine through collagen protein powder and or supplements, and adding creatine as well as a supplement, about 5 grams a day, would also be helpful on the methylation cycle of things. And that would be a really comprehensive approach, but you know, we can do, if the person's game for it, we can do the choline with diet. We can have one B complex that can cover the B2, B6, B12. And then we can have one inexpensive powdered supplement for the creatine. And then we can do glycine if they want through a collagen protein powder that's more, feels like a food thing that they can add to smoothies or coffee or things like that. Or we can do glycine as a powder, which is actually a pretty tasty sweet amino acid that lowers blood sugar. So there might be reason in this case to do that if there's high blood sugar as well, which I'm not sure if there is. So MTRR, it's saying that that there may be some associated conditions related to vitamin B12, but not all studies, you know, corroborate that. So it's kind of, again, I don't think MTRR has, in my opinion, enough research to be clinically relevant. So CBS, we have the transsulfuration pathway. So from homocysteine, we're going down through CBS to the transsulfuration pathway. And this is really about cysteine, and it's about sulfur and sulfate and sulfite, glutathione. So there are several things that happen in this pathway. We see really the only issues that we have here is a CBS mutation and then a GST mutation. So there may be some difficulty with creating glutathione in this case, so we may want to give glutathione. And that would be a reasonable idea from the cardiovascular perspective to give glutathione anyway. In some cases, some people might be sulfur sensitive with a CBS mutation. I don't know if that would be the case here or not, because there's this controversy. See, most studies indicate upregulation, but the science is mixed. So there could be up or down regulation. Do we, you know, is it going up or is it going down? Right? And that's going to determine whether someone might be sensitive to sulfur or not. So, you know, since we don't know that, unless someone looks like they're reactive to sulfur containing foods and supplements, like if they can't take NAC and they have a reaction to NAC, if they don't do well with eggs and onions and garlic and asparagus and mushrooms, then we might start to think, hey, you know, there might be something to the CBS mutation in their case leading to sulfur sensitivity, and we might look at a low sulfur diet, and we might look at molybdenum supplementation, and we might look at a couple other things in that case. So you might evaluate her diet to see if she has sensitivities to sulfur containing things or foods. And if so, then you might look at low sulfur diet. But, you know, I wouldn't do it otherwise. I don't want to, you know, restrict her diet more. She's already trying to do the fat regulation, and that's much more important for the hypercholesterolemia. So unless there's noticeable and significant issues from sulfur-containing compounds, I wouldn't worry about that. Okay, so then SOD2, that no real issues there. GSTP1, so here, this is about glutathione, and we don't know if it's going up or down. So again, we don't really have a lot of clinical data. There's another possible point to leukemia, so we want to, you know, make sure we're checking a CBC, seeing if those white blood cells are elevated. And it'd be worth giving glutathione anyway, just to, because of the antioxidative nature of glutathione and the oxidative stress component for cardiovascular disease, and that being the chief thing we're working with, glutathione, if we're not already giving it, would be helpful to give. Okay, so then we have the biopterin pathway. So we do have COMT here that's related to dopamine, and we see that COMT has that homozygous mutation. And then we have the ENOS, which relates to nitric oxide and citrulline. Best way to help this arginine to nitric oxide citrulline conversion is through citrulline amino acid supplementation. You know, I think that's relevant if there's high blood pressure, for sure. We would want to support that pathway. So one of the ways, if that were to be expressing in a negative direction, we might see hypertension. Another thing we might see is difficulty with protein metabolism and digestion, like the ammonia acid cycle might build up ammonia. So if we see signs of ammonia buildup, or if we look at an organic acid test and we see markers related to ammonia buildup, then we definitely want to give citrulline. I would see no problem with giving citrulline proactively and see if it helps. I would give probably a powdered version because it doesn't taste very bad and you can take a higher dose that way. So a powdered version of citrulline would be a reasonable idea there. And then for COMT, we see that there's potentially an effect on dopamine. Serotonin can impact COMT a little bit, but dopamine's the big thing that gets impacted by COMT. So let's go down and look a little further. So the ENOS, we see with this variant, it is theorized to decrease NOS3 activity, but theorized, and actually are two different things. Again, not a lot of research here. So we, of course, want to monitor blood pressure. There's already cardiovascular disease risk. And, if there might be any issues with, things like protein metabolism or elevated blood pressure, then we definitely want to add some citrulline in. And by the way, a lot of people use arginine, but citrulline increases arginine levels in the blood better than arginine does, interestingly enough. So a combo supplement is fine, or just citrulline will convert in the kidneys into arginine and increase both arginine and citrulline levels. So that's the preferred amino acid for ammonia buildup issues for nitric oxide production. So keep that in mind. Okay, then we have MEOA. And this has to do with mitochondrial membranes. This is normal wild type, so we're not going to cover that. COMT, here we see, could lead to a 40% reduction, up to a 40% reduction on average in COMT activity. So this enzyme might be reduced by not quite half, but close. And interestingly, one thing it can be associated with is higher dopamine levels. So if dopamine levels are increased, that can lead to mental emotional issues. So some people can experience ADD, ADHD with these higher dopamine levels. Some people might not notice much at all, so they might, be just fine. And again, these genes don't express in everyone. If there's higher blood pressure, that could be in part due to this increased dopamine. Certain kinds of behavioral things can play a role, but there's not, it's really hard to say. So basically, COMT might be contributing to excessive dopamine. We might want to give something like 5-HTP to boost serotonin if there are some of those mental emotional issues. We might be able to, just ignore it. It depends on what's happening. The biggest thing that I'm concerned about in this particular case is the blood pressure, the cardiovascular issue, and, if there are challenges, mental emotional challenges with diet, then we might look at something to help with directly working on this dopamine pathway. The dopamine pathway, I don't necessarily think, is the highest priority, even though we have these, even though it appears here and we see the homozygous mutation, it you know, we don't necessarily need to do a lot directly with it. So by increasing methylation, we might help. Magnesium might help. So, you know, those are, and then possibly increasing serotonin with 5-HTP. Those would all be things we could do. I don't think they're necessary. And again, with these genetic things, we can just overload people with supplements if we're not very diligent about looking at their case, looking at what's expressing, looking at what's not expressing, looking at what has clinical relevance, looking at what does not. And many people shoot in the dark trying to do a bunch of things where there's not good research to support those things that they're doing. So next, after COMT, we see the histamine pathway. We have a couple of things in the histamine pathway that may be playing a role. Generally, low methylation is going to increase histamine. So that already is suggestive that there may be some histamine issue. If those other ones are expressing, we don't know if they are, but if homocysteine is elevated, then we would expect that histamine would be elevated potentially from that, not always, but potentially. So we have the AOC1, which is related to the DAO activity. We don't know for sure if it's going down, but we think it might be. There could be an association with migraines and hypersensitivity to non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. We can give, usually copper and vitamin C are the two big ones I'll give to support DAO production. Sometimes I'll give DAO directly as an enzyme to take while eating food for a while. So, you know, it may or may not help the situation. It's probably not going to help the cholesterol. It may help if there are allergic symptoms, migraines, if there's a lot of stuffiness, if there are rashes, fatigue, brain fog, may help those things. Then we see the next one is MAOB and the schizophrenia is one condition associated, but that's really all the research we have. So not really much to do about that. And then we have NAT2. There might be increased time to clear certain drugs, environmental chemicals, histamines. So, you know, that might make someone a little more sensitive to certain things, might increase chances for cancer, asthma, neurological disorders. Again, you know, not much clinical relevance, not really going to do much here. And then here's bonus SNPs. So these are a few things that, you know, came in that aren't in those pathways, but that people are, you know, that there's reporting of. So this BCL1 has to do with beta carotene to vitamin A conversion. So as you may know, beta carotene is not vitamin A, even though it's reported to be vitamin A on vitamins. And it's actually a precursor that needs to be converted into retinol. Retinol is vitamin A. And that conversion might be poor in some people. We don't really understand these mutations much yet, but because these mutations might be associated with beta carotene to vitamin A, and because vitamin A status is low in a lot of individuals, and because the preformed kind of vitamin A, retinol, directly skips over this conversion, then we might generally recommend, I generally recommend to a lot of people, to take some cod liver oil or eat a quarter to a half pound of liver per week, or both, in order to try to get about 3,500 IU a day of preformed vitamin A already as retinol, not just the beta carotene. So this is especially true in vegan and vegetarian individuals where they're not going to get any of the preformed, but you know, it's true in a lot of people who aren't going to eat liver that they're not going to get a lot of that preformed vitamin A. So cod liver oil is great for that, and about a teaspoon a day of a brand that standardizes the level of vitamin A and reports it on the label. And you can see that that vitamin A is about 3,500 IU or so in a teaspoon, then a teaspoon a day would be great. There's, you know, some good brands out there. Probably the most cost-effective brand, probably the highest quality brand is Roses. And the probably the most cost-effective, lowest cost for high vitamin A is a Garden of Life Old World Icelandic cod liver oil. It has about 4,500 IU per teaspoon. So those are some options on the cod liver oil. Then we see here that FUT2 might have to do with B12 deficiency and or gut microbiota issues. Not a lot of research here, but, you know, we want to assess vitamin B12 levels. For sure, for everyone anyway. This NQO1 is potentially relevant for this person. There may be an issue converting ubiquinone into active ubiquinol. So we may want to, if we're supplementing CoQ10, make sure we're using the ubiquinol form in this individual. I would do the ubiquinol form by default anyway. So this HFE may be slight increased hemochromatosis risk. So again, testing ferritin, transferrin saturation, serum iron would all be helpful and appropriate. PEMPT. So PEMPT does not say someone's going to be more deficient in choline, but it does say that they're more likely to have non-alcoholic fatty liver develop in the presence of deficient choline. So we want to double choline for other reasons in her case, but we definitely want to make sure choline status is sufficient. FADS 1 has to do with higher than average arachidonic acid. That's usually a good thing. I like arachidonic acid levels to be, you know, higher than average. High normal is my preference for arachidonic acid levels. But LDL and other total cholesterol levels might be upregulated. So we want to limit polyunsaturated fatty acids. And I don't think necessarily that we want to limit arachidonic acid, even though that's what it's saying. You know, we could get a marker on fatty acids and see where they're at, but I wouldn't restrict arachidonic acid, even though that's saying that. Again, this is trying to base too much on a gene that we don't have enough data on, but I would reduce omega-6 PUFAs and focus on MUFAs, monounsaturated fatty acids, which we already talked about last time. FADS1 may have lower than average phosphatidylcholine levels due to altered phosphatidylcholine metabolism. We've already talked a lot about choline. Here's some additional support that we want to look at choline levels and make sure they're adequate. Maybe increase them. FADS2 may have lower conversion of ALA to EPA, so flax oil and things like that that have ALA may not convert to EPA as efficiently as in other individuals. So taking fish oil or DHA from algae oil may be helpful. TNF-alpha, so this could be associated with an upregulation of TNF-alpha production. We could measure TNF-alpha in the blood and see if it's upregulated. That's an inflammatory marker. And we want to do things to reduce inflammation. And it's talking about magnesium, zinc, vitamin D, chromium, and avoidance of smoking, alcohol, lead, gluten, and elevated blood glucose and insulin, which are all reasonable things to do. And that's all that we see other than the ApoE showed indeterminate. But if we had an ApoE4 allele, then that would basically just give us increased risk for Alzheimer's, dementia, and increased cholesterol, and be suggestive that we want to increase, you know, exercise is the one thing that's really showed lowering that risk for ApoE. So make sure there's adequate exercise every week happening. So that was a lot. I know I spent a long time on this. I wanted to go through it thoroughly and give some of that background explanation, so you have an understanding. So now let's, you know, give a general sense for, okay, we have this understanding. So what are we doing in this case? Well, we want to look at choline. So for supplementation, we want to look at a B complex that includes methylfolate and methylcobalamin and P5P and riboflavin. Creatine, 5 grams daily. We want to look at glycine or collagen protein. So glycine would be 3 grams, 3 times daily with meals and or one dose before bed, or collagen protein, 20 grams twice daily. We want to look at choline supplement or from food, probably 2 to 3 egg yolks per day and 1/4 to 1/2 pound liver per week, or liver capsules, or phosphatidylcholine as a supplement, or something like sunflower lecithin for phosphatidylcholine. Then we want to look at glutathione. We could use 1,000 milligrams per day if it's oral glutathione, or 200 milligrams liposomal. So that's based on the information that we have just from this genetic. Let's see if we missed anything. Oh, the cod liver oil. One teaspoon per day, if not eating liver and getting around 3,500 IU on average of retinol already from liver and or other sources. And at 3,500 IU a day, there should be no need to monitor liver enzymes. If you go much higher than that, then you might have to monitor liver enzymes on the vitamin A. So you just want to look at that total. So all of those would be things based on this lab screening or testing for we want homocysteine to assess methylation status, and we want to target less than 7, or say less than 8, because 7 is fine. And then we want to look at ferritin to be, you know, 50 to 150 would be a good range for ferritin to be. And then transferrin saturation, we would want to be About 30 to 45 would be a good place to be on transferrin saturation. So those would be a few labs to target to gather a little bit more information. And then we have a couple optional things, and that could be citrulline, about 1 teaspoon per day. And that's especially if there's high blood pressure or protein metabolism issues or ammonia buildup, or we see evidence of that on something like an organic acids test. There could be some vitamin C and or copper and or DAO. I don't think that's necessary, but it could, you know, if there are signs of histamine issues, then we could look at those. And then if there are signs of serotonin deficiency, we could look at 5-HTP supplement. So there we go. That was a lot. Hope that was really helpful for you guys. Let me know if you have any follow-up questions on that. We'll move on to the next part of this case. Let me just copy this info since we're going to go on here. So we went through the DNA test. Okay. Two additional questions. If she does start on a statin drug, are there any supplements aside from CoQ10 that would be indicated to continue to take along with the statin once we get follow-up labs to assess if anything else has changed? Not really. Any extra things beyond CoQ10 and some of the other stuff that we're already doing, like a B complex and a multi-mineral, those would be the big things to do in the case of starting on a statin drug. Now, of course, red rice yeast would be a way to have a statin-like effect more naturally with potentially some additional cofactors in it. So that could be helpful. And then the Chinese medicine treatment. So let us take a look at that. Okay, so it's looking like we have Chaihu, which is Bupleurim, which is for the liver. We have Bai Xiao, which is peony, and that's going to be also for the liver. Fu Ling is a mushroom, and it helps drain damp. Dongui is angelica root, and it helps with blood and a lot of reproductive issues. Sheng Di Huang is Romani, and it helps with kidney and adrenal issues. Gan Sao licorice helps with adrenal issues and harmonizes the formula. Jue Mingzi is a seed that's, I believe that is castor seed, if I'm not mistaken. Cassia is the name there, and that can relieve constipation. It can help with some thyroid stuff. Tianma is going to, and Goteng, Tianma and Goteng often go together with certain liver issues, especially headaches and migraines. Those are used a lot. Don Shen is used for heart stuff a lot, and that's a great herb. Shanjia is also used for heart stuff. That's actually hawthorn. So Shanjia and Don Shen, cardiovascular stuff, definitely those are good things you could take. Hawthorn root from any source. Don Shen is salvia root. That I've only seen in Chinese medicine herbals. And it looks like this study is about, okay, father and mother suffer from hypercholesterolemia, total cholesterol 487. defecation every 2 days. So that seems actually like constipation, even though it says regular. Decrease in the frequency of migraines and their intensity. This doesn't say, okay, LDL 241, total 300. A year after treatment, total went to 268. Okay, well, it seems to me that this formula, the parts that are focused on the cholesterol are going to be the Donshan and the Shanja, and that is more focused on the heart. Goteng and Tianma are a little more around migraines. Jue Mingzi may be around the constipation a little bit. These may be for some of the reproductive stuff. And these are for the liver in general, which of course might relate to cholesterol and migraines. So we do carry a formula called Donshan Shanja Yin in the clinic, which is a lot of Donshan and Shanja. And I do use that in some cases with cardiovascular issues, including high cholesterol. So I can speak to that being effective in some cases. So I do think it's worth considering a formula that contains Donshan and Shanja together with a bunch of the other stuff that we're doing here in this case. And then, Brooke, if you want to also give a complete protocol for what y'all have her on with her numbers when you get them and how they've changed, then we can assess and update and revise that protocol. I want to make sure glutathione's on there. I want to make sure that there is another one that I'm almost sure we didn't put on there that we could put, which is called bergamot, that can lower cholesterol significantly. So let's look at a bergamot and do a reevaluation here. Let's look at bergamot. Let's make sure glutathione's on there, and then give me the complete thing. Make sure we have pantothene and we have annatotocotrienols and we have CoQ10 and a few other things. So let's go ahead and, you know, have you send in that for together with the results, and we'll do an analysis of how she's doing so far. So the other thing I'll mention is pomegranate juice can reduce that intima media thickness. So pomegranate juice, I think, would be a really helpful thing. It's well worth the sugar load. And I would take it with a meal so you don't get a blood sugar response from it. But even diabetics were shown to actually lower some blood sugar from pomegranate, probably because of the polyphenols and the impact on the gut. Be sure to always work with the gut when cholesterol issues are going on. And remember, cholesterol molecules have LPS receptors on them. So if there's endotoxemia from gut infections or other chronic infections in the body, those can worsen a cholesterol issue. If there's low thyroid, that can worsen a cholesterol issue. So be sure to address thyroid and chronic infections as well and be testing for those. Let me know. So it looks like there was high ApoB, LPA, homocysteine, and other elevated cardiometabolic markers. So that's good. I'm glad we got those. What are those numbers? What were they before? Do we have a change in those numbers? We can talk through a little more about LP little a, but that's usually an indicator of oxidative stress. So we definitely want to look at glutathione as an antioxidant. We may want to look at other antioxidants like grape seed extract as well, or a supplement like Vital Vasc by Zymogen that has some cordyart and grape seed extract in it. I want to know about her blood pressure as well. So because she did have elevated homocysteine, we definitely do want to increase the do all that B vitamins and so B complex, including B2, methylfolate, methylcobalamin, and P5P. We want extra choline in the diet and or a supplement. We want creatine and we want glycine in this case. So let's make sure to address those if they're not already addressed. Thank you so much for the question, Brooke. Another question from Brooke. This is the same question. So we do have the additional genetic results. Okay. So it looks like we will have time. So I'm going to go through those additional genetic results. Okay, so in this case, the homozygous, we have MTRR, we have the ENOS, we have the AOC1 related to DAO, we have the BCO1, we have the PEMT related to fatty liver, we have the FADS1, we have the APOE, but not, so we do have two APOEs here, looks like a 3-3, no increased risk from APOE in this case. So we can blast through this one a lot quicker since we've already done these. So we do have a heterozygous in SLC and MTHFD1 and a heterozygous in MTHFR. The MTHFR heterozygous is 677T, which is more of a decreased activity than the 1298A. So 30% decreased activity. So we want to look at homocysteine, see if it's elevated. If so, do all the same stuff for methylation that we did. So let's look at homocysteine. If it's above 7, let's look at vitamin B2, methylfolate, methylcobalamin, P5P, choline, and glycine and creatine, or some combination of those at a minimum, do riboflavin or vitamin B2. And next best would be add choline into the diet or as a supplement. And then after that would be to add the glycine and the creatine. Then we have the MTRR, not much, not meaningful. We have the CVS. So probably not going to make a big deal out of it unless this person is sensitive to NAC and sulfur containing foods like eggs and onions and garlic and asparagus and mushrooms. If they are, might try a low sulfur diet and some molybdenum. We see GST, so we might want glutathione in this case. We see sod, additionally glutathione will help there with the antioxidative status. So glutathione might be worth supplementing in this case. We see here, yeah, this is related to the glutathione piece. Selenium might be helpful in this case, just a multi-mineral. I would just put on a multi-mineral. I would use a multi-mineral that contains a little bit of copper, a little bit of zinc and selenium, a little bit of magnesium, and or magnesium could be separate if it's a trace mineral supplement. But I like Minrex by Zymogen is a really good one. Do one twice a day of Minrex. We could try some citrulline in this case, teaspoon a day. And then if there's low serotonin signs, mental emotional stuff, we might try 100 milligrams 5-HTP at night. If we have a multi-mineral that already has copper, that's going to help with DAO. We might also add vitamin C. And if there's still signs of histamine issues, rashes, sneezing, itching, brain fog, fatigue, then we might also try some DAO enzyme. Zymogen makes a DAO supplement that's good. We could do quercetin. Be another one. We probably do want to look at preformed vitamin A, so cod liver oil, and or a quarter to a half pound of liver. We want to assess B12 status, maybe trial B12 supplements and or injections just to see if they're helpful. And we want to get adequate choline so as to prevent non-alcoholic fatty liver and the increased risk here. Avoid PUFAs, but that's basically for everyone. No additional ApoE risk. Assess vitamin D status and make sure that vitamin D is at least at 35 or parathyroid is suppressed below 30. So you can see we can blast through these pretty quick once you understand all the background info and we've gone over the pathways. Once you understand the underlying mechanisms, we can go through pretty quick. Basically, in this case, we want a homocysteine level. We're not as concerned about iron, so we don't need to do that. It's good to get a ferritin just in general for people regardless of genetics, but we're not concerned based on genetics. We are wanting to make sure adequate choline comes into the picture. So we want to look at homocysteine in the blood. And probably we could do an organic acids test to assess for ammonia status, and or a Nutrival would be good. So Nutrival by Genova or organic acids test by Genova or Great Plains. And so mostly homocysteine and homocysteine and ammonia cycle. And then we could supplement with some of those things for the methylation cycle like we talked about and make sure adequate choline's in the diet. So, and then preformed vitamin A, cod liver oil and or liver. So that was pretty quick. All righty, here we've got female, age 50, chief complaint, benign breast cyst. No symptoms but concern. Doctor's pushing for regular mammograms, but she doesn't want to have mammograms given the negative aspect. So psychologically, she's concerned about the cyst. So you may or may not be aware of thermography, but if you're not, some medical clinics and mostly naturopathic clinics have thermography equipment where you can do a thermography scan, which looks for, so it won't show what's present currently because you get a baseline, but then you can compare the baseline to doing them every 6 months or a year. They're not problematic in the way that mammograms are in terms of the toxic exposure. So one way you could do mammograms or recommend someone do mammograms is that they do thermography on a more regular basis. And then if the thermography shows a change, go in for mammograms and then do the mammograms on still do the mammograms, but do them on a less aggressive schedule if you have the thermography. So that would be one recommendation on diagnostics. So she's been working on reducing estrogen dominance and will test hormones in a few weeks. She tested low in iodine 1 year ago and is supplementing a maintenance dose of 150 micrograms. Can't really go higher as she has mild Hashimoto's. Say mild because TPO antibody and thyroglobulin antibody are not very high, around 10 to 25. She's trying to reduce stress and manage it better. Non-serving diet, lifestyle choices, and or mindset issues. So drinks wine, 10 to 15 glasses of red wine per week, organic if it's available. It's a tough one for her, and she doesn't really want to give it up. Reducing is something she says she can try to do, but she hasn't started yet to do so. How much does stress play overall? Somewhat. She does have a very stressful life, but I don't think she handles stress very well. Whenever she gets busy, that stresses her out. Any mental, emotional, spiritual, not that I'm aware of. Other pertinent information. Main question is, how do we work with reducing breast cysts and preventing new cysts from forming? Okay, so first thing with estrogen dominance is it's a good thing you're working on it. 10 to 15 glasses of red wine per week. So alcohol is an aromatase upregulator. So it's going to push conversion of testosterone to estrogen, which could worsen estrogen dominance. So the alcohol is going to be an obstacle in this case. You know, we can increase DIM, and sulforaphane, and, that might be able to help a little bit. But the wine consumption is going to be an issue. I don't see a way around that. So if we could find an alternate strategy, if we could do, weekends only, no 2 days in a row, limit it to two on a given day or one and a half. These all are going to be things that you're going to have to negotiate with her on. You could take molybdenum to try to, reduce some of the sulfite impact that's happening. You could switch to white wine for some of it to reduce some of that sulfite impact that's happening. So those are suggestions that might be helpful, but they're not going to get around the fact that alcohol is an aromatase upregulator. So that's going to be a big thing. Let's see how the hormone tests do, but alcohol is going to be a big conversation here, negotiating, finding strategies, finding alternatives. Even if someone is able to, let's say they enjoy kava and that's an altered state that works for them, or they enjoy cannabis and that's an altered state that works for them and they're in a state that allows that, or these might be things to say, hey, can you, I don't like to necessarily swap one habit for another habit always, but if someone really, they like their altered states, then maybe providing a different altered state, ideally it's meditation, and that would be an ideal habit swap. But barring that, seeing if there would be another habit would be a really good thing in this case. And then on the estrogen dominance piece, okay, so she's taking 150 micrograms of iodine. That's good. That's probably iodine's the number one thing we're going to think with cystic breasts. There's 150 micrograms is a decent dose. Going higher does present a risk with thyroid antibodies. However, you can probably go higher if you get adequate selenium and still not push those antibodies. Probably is the operative word. We'll need a test to make sure. But I would consider upping that iodine dose together with about 200 micrograms of selenium and not rely on Brazil nuts for selenium, because they're so varied in terms of how much selenium they have. Could be as little as 30 micrograms, could be over 100 micrograms. It's so varied that it would be better to do a selenium supplement, do 200 micrograms of selenium in that supplement, and then I would go higher on the iodine supplement. I would keep it under 1100 micrograms with thyroid antibody history, but I would go up to, 300 for a few weeks. And if that's tolerated and the antibodies don't rise, I'd go up to 600, 500 or 600. And then if the antibodies still don't rise, I would go up to 1000 micrograms and then maybe 1100. I wouldn't, I'd kind of cap it at 1100. I would also think about doing some of it topically. She takes 150 microgram orally, and then maybe she topically applies 3 milligrams or so, but that of course is not going to be absorbed at, the same as if she took it orally, or anywhere close to the same as if she took it orally. But if she can absorb it into the breast tissue directly, that might help increase locally the iodine in that area more so than systemically. So I would suggest 200 micrograms of selenium plus, keep the oral dose the same, but add topical, take a topical iodine and do a few drops of that topical on each breast. So that might be, a couple milligrams, one and a half milligrams or so of iodine on each breast topically. Do that for a month, retest antibodies, make sure they're not rising. And then make sure that she's taking the selenium together with it. So that plus working on the alcohol, those would be big things. And then stress management, sleep, nutrition, all that basic stuff, of course, I think you're already addressing, but make sure you get those foundations down and aren't missing anything in those foundations. So that's going to be the best strategy, I think, for now. So go ahead and give that a go and see if there's some progress from that front. What's the best way to take probiotic supplements? Do they need to be taken on an empty stomach separately away from other supplements or food? Or can you take a probiotic with all your other supplements and then eat breakfast? So it depends, is the answer, as usually it is. So depends on what kind of probiotics, on what the alternative strategies are. So for example, spore-based probiotics. So Bacillus coagulans, Bacillus subtilis, these actually are better to take with meals because they do actually feed on some of the protein and things in the meals. So if we're doing, let's say, Probiomax IG26, or if we're doing Megaspore Biotic, or if we're doing Biospora, or any of those spore-based probiotics, I always recommend those with meals. Some other probiotics are probably a little bit better away from meals, lacto-bifido blends. I tend to recommend away from meals at bedtime or first thing in the morning. Keep it by your toothpaste, keep it in the bathroom, keep a bottle of water there so that you can remember to take those as you're brushing your teeth or right before or after you're brushing your teeth. Might be hard to do while you're brushing your teeth, but before or after. So lacto-bifido blends are that way. Saccharomyces boulardii can be taken with or without meals. Probably slightly better without, but a lot of times just for compliance, I have people take it with meals. And even lacto-bifido blends, if a person is forgetting doses, skipping doses, going to have a hard time with away from meals, I'd still rather them take it with meals than take it spottily or haphazardly away from meals. So usually lacto-bifido blends, if someone can successfully do it, I recommend bedtime or first thing in the morning. Same with Saccharomyces boulardii. But if they're having a hard time with that, or I suspect they'll have a hard time with that, or if they say they might have a hard time with that, then I will instead recommend those with meals. Spore-based probiotics, I will always recommend with meals. Question about hypoglycemia and toxicity. Seen a few clients with difficulty balancing their blood sugar to avoid low blood sugar crashes. With low carb, high protein, fat diet, and carefully managing an eating schedule of every 3 to 4 hours, they can avoid the crashes, but if they're late to a meal or snack, they still crash. Chromium, zinc, vanadium, and adrenal support helps, but still they are prone to that crash if diet and schedule is not perfect. I've noticed that these same clients have toxicity issues, poor response to detox protocols, with Herx reactions from antimicrobials or detox, homeopathic, or nutraceutical protocols. Is there a correlation between faulty detox and inability to control hypoglycemia? I think through possible mechanisms, toxins create increase in cortisol, which dysregulates HPA. Notice leads to hypoglycemia. Is there another mechanism? And to correct, do you work further on HPA or detox? Thanks. All righty. So last question here. So Hypoglycemia can be a tricky one to work with. I do often see it relate to HPA axis dysfunction. So commonly people with hypoglycemia have a chronically hypocortisolism. So their cortisol tends to be, their free cortisol tends to be low. And often that's associated with that low blood sugar pattern. And usually there's low blood pressure as well, because that cortisol and the norepinephrine and epinephrine regulate blood pressure. So often we see them all downregulated together. We see low blood sugar, we see low blood pressure, we see fatigue, we see low cortisol of the free portion. Toxicity is an interesting question. Toxicity can impact the HPA axis for sure, and could be one cause of HPA axis dysregulation. We know, for example, that mold toxin can downregulate VIP and melanocyte stimulating hormone. So we have, let me pull open a chart here. So while I'm pulling open this chart, the HPA axis can be dysregulated for a variety of reasons. Hypoglycemia can happen for a variety of reasons. Both of them are linked in many cases. So I do see commonly low adrenal function, low HPA axis function, together with hypoglycemic issues and low blood pressure and frequent urination, because the adrenals make antidiuretic hormone, which regulates urination. And auxin issues can come as a result of, let's see, I think I can pull this up this way. Here we go. So this is a biotoxin pathway chart. I know it's a little blurry here. I wonder if we have a higher res version. This one's a little higher res. Okay, so we have, when we're looking at biotoxin impact on the HPA axis, we can see that there's an effect where the biotoxin can, via the toll-like receptor, impact in the fat cells, storing the fat cells, increase the cytokines and increase leptin. And cytokines are inflammatory, pro-inflammatory constituents, and the leptin is that full signal. And so, especially in biotoxin exposure where there's also been fat accumulation, we see quite a big impact on the hypothalamus. But even if there's not a ton of fat accumulation, there's always some adipose tissue that can collect biotoxin. Biotoxin can also affect the nerve cell and generally will lead to increased cytotoxin through a variety of mechanisms. And one of the things that happens in the hypothalamus is that we see that VIP and MSH, so melanocyte stimulating hormone, is a hormone that has a lot of functions. And those functions include reducing antidiuretic hormone and include changes in ACTH levels, which ACTH stimulates cortisol. So if we have reduced MSH, we can impact those ACTH levels. We can impact cortisol, and it can go in both directions with cortisol in terms of raising or lowering it, depending on the biotoxin pathway, depending on adipose tissue. We'll usually see higher cortisol, and with less adipose tissue, we may see lower cortisol. And then we have sleep disturbance, chronic pain, gastrointestinal problems, prolonged illness, et cetera. So we see this in general, we see with biotoxin illness that that Shoemaker's observation is the reduced MSH leads to elevated cortisol and ACTH in the early stages, but then drop to excessively low levels in the later stages. And this is true generally for, I'm going to turn on a light here. This is true generally for a lot of chronic stress. It will impact with elevated cortisol first, and then it'll go to deficient cortisol later stage when the stress becomes chronic. And part of that has to do with the receptor sites for cortisol in the hypothalamus and the pituitary have these regulatory mechanisms by which they increase or decrease how sensitive they are to cortisol, and they increase or decrease how many of those receptors to cortisol are expressing. And we get this resistance to cortisol where less receptors are expressing and they're less sensitive, so that the same level of cortisol appears to the brain to be different than it is, and we get an up or down regulation chronically of the amount of free cortisol that's available to the body. So, yes, there can be a toxin connection that can disrupt the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, and in the beginning, increase cortisol, but later decrease it significantly. And that decrease, of course, then can be associated with low blood sugar and hypoglycemic issues. And so there may very well be toxic burden associated, but having poor response to detox protocols will indicate that there probably are toxic burden issues. And it may indicate that there's also mast cell activation and or histamine intolerance in many of those cases as well. And if there's mast cell activation and or histamine issues, then you'll want to focus on the histamine prior to doing too much with detoxification protocols, and or you'll want to go super slow on those detoxification protocols. And you might want to look at adrenal support and HPA axis regulation and stress management tools in addition to the supplement protocols in those cases as well. Chronic infection may also play a role. We do see chronic HPA dysregulation in the presence of chronic infection as well. So I would consider chronic infection as well as toxicity, as well as MCAS or mast cell activation syndrome in these cases. They could also have hypersensitive immune responses. in something like low-dose immunotherapy or low-dose allergy therapy, antigen therapy might be appropriate for them in conjunction with whatever else you're doing. So you might look at LDI or LDA together with what you're doing, and that can potentially be helpful with some of those super sensitive individuals. You can look at a supplement like cytodetox and going really slow because it's a liquid. People do have reactions to it, but you can go really slow, like one drop once per day for a few days and then increase from there slowly. And you can also look at increasing indirectly through, rather than binders, looking at glutathione and alpha-lipoic acid or R-lipoic acid as well for upregulating detoxification. So that would be another way to go about it and help in that person's case. I would also look for B12 issues. I've seen a really severe case of hypoglycemia that had elevated antiparietal cell antibodies. And so the parietal cells were not producing adequate stomach acid or intrinsic factor, and vitamin B12 was very low, and vitamin B12 injections were very helpful in that case. In that case, histamine was also a big issue as well. And methylation was an issue that was driving some of that histamine and mast cell activation. So looking at methylation would be recommended as well in this case. And then a meditation retreat would be huge if the person could do it, because that's one of the best things to reset that HPA axis that I found. So if someone could do a week long, or if not a week long, at least a weekend meditation retreat, that could be huge for resetting the HPA axis. Circadian rhythm could be reset with about 6 days of camping. So that would be an option. Meditation retreat would do even better for the full chronic stress response and cortisol regulation. So that should be some things to get you started on looking a little deeper. You can look, of course, at some markers that can point to histamine. So you could look at plasma histamine levels in the blood. You could look at tryptase. You could look at DAO enzyme and a ratio between histamine and DAO enzyme that's available through Dunwoody Labs in their advanced intestinal barrier permeability test. So that would be a good one to do. You can look through LabCorp at plasma histamine and tryptase as options as well. And you can look at homocysteine related to methylation. And you can look at glutathione and alpha-lipoic acid or R-lipoic acid related to detoxification. And then you can look at cytodetox as a really, really slow start to a binder, very small doses, working your way up slowly. And then you can look at additional adrenal support and cortisol support, and then you can look at LDI or LDA as well. What if they're taking antimicrobials? Take at a separate time. So take what at a separate time if they're taking antimicrobials? Take what as a separate time than the antimicrobials related to the probiotic question. Okay, so back to probiotics. So probiotics, if someone's taking antibiotics, are taking probiotics contraindicated, or might they be helpful? And if they are helpful, do you need to take them at a different time? So the research on this actually is suggestive that You can take probiotics together with antimicrobials, and you can take them at the same time. Now, one research study, interestingly, had antibiotics, and after antibiotics, there was a lacto-bifido blend of probiotic that one group took, and the other group did not take any probiotic. And the group that did not take any probiotic restored their gut flora post-antibiotic much quicker, I think at least 5 weeks quicker, than the group that took the lacto-bifido probiotic. And now that's after, not during. And that leaves a lot of unanswered questions. So I don't have the answers to those questions, unfortunately, but I will say that it may be that a lacto-bifido probiotic post-antibiotic might inhibit the body's natural restoration of microbiota diversity and flora. I would suspect, but I don't know, that something like Saccharomyces boulardii and or spore-based probiotics might behave differently. So right now, my recommendation when someone's taking antimicrobials and or an antibiotic is typically to take Saccharomyces boulardii and or a spore-based probiotic, but to avoid a lacto-bifido probiotic after for 5 weeks, and then look at starting a lacto-bifido probiotic at that 5 week point after stopping antimicrobials. So that's my current strategy, and it's an interesting one, I know, but I do believe that there's no good evidence saying that you need to take antimicrobials apart from probiotics. There is good evidence showing that probiotics have a positive effect even when they're dead. So you don't have to necessarily worry about killing them off. Saccharomyces boulardii is a yeast, so it probably won't be affected by an antibiotic in the same way, but it might be affected by anti-yeast medications and or supplements that deal with yeast and bacteria. And then Bacillus, I don't know how they're going to be impacted, but they tend to release antimicrobial. So spore-based probiotics actually release antimicrobial constituents themselves. So that's part of why I suspect they may be beneficial. And part of why I suspect Saccharomyces boulardii may be beneficial is because it's a healthful yeast that crowds out pathogenic yeast. So during antibiotics or antimicrobial protocols, I think a lacto-bifido blend is fine to do and fine to take together with the antibiotic or antimicrobial, but usually I steer clear of them after antibiotics or antimicrobials for 5 weeks, and during, I might also steer clear and favor Saccharomyces boulardii and or spore-based probiotics. And then after, I would definitely favor Saccharomyces boulardii and spore-based probiotics and avoiding lacto-bifido blend probiotics for 5 weeks. So hopefully that helps that question. I do typically dose the spore-based probiotics with meals, even if someone's taking antimicrobials. I will typically dose Saccharomyces boulardii at bedtime or first thing in the morning, away from antimicrobials, especially if they're anti-yeast, if the person is able, willing to do that, and it's not going to interfere with compliance. All righty, I believe that's all the questions we have for today. So thank you all so much for attending. Hopefully this was really helpful. We got to dive deep into genetics today, which was great. Dive deep into probiotics, dive deep into some of the toxin hypoglycemia connection. So thank you all for attending. Please keep submitting your questions and let us know what we can do to continue to provide you great info. Have a wonderful rest of your evening, and I will look forward to next time. Take care.